At the height of the Cold War, the U.S. had over 30,000 nuclear warheads stockpiled. That number is now under 5,000. In April 2010, President Obama signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Russia. It was an agreement to reduce nuclear arms. But was that treaty enough, or is further nuclear arms control needed? Stephen Pfeiffer is director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative and author of a new book, The Opportunity, Next Steps in Reducing Nuclear Arms. He'll take a look at that question tonight during a free lecture at UNLV. The lecture takes place at 5:30 this afternoon in the Greenspun Hall Auditorium. And Stephen Pfeiffer is with us now. Welcome to KNPR. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
In the 1960s, the United States, had over 30,000 warheads stockpiled, and the number has been cut by about 5/6. So where have all those weapons gone?
Well, a lot of the weapons have been dismantled, been eliminated. But we still have in the U.S. inventory now about 5,000 nuclear weapons. And there's probably several thousand others that are in the Department of Energy's custody that are just waiting their date with the guy with the screwdriver to be taken apart.
Hmm. So I guess even though we've reduced it by so much, I find myself thinking, okay, what are we going to do with 5,000 nuclear warheads? Why do we need that size stockpile?
Well, this is one of the arguments that we make in the book, is we think that in 2013 there's an opportunity to reduce the nuclear threat further. As a general rule, we would argue that the fewer the number of nuclear weapons that reach the United States, the better it is for America. It makes America safer and more secure. Moreover, there's an opportunity to save money. We're on this verge of having to make decisions about replacing our ballistic missile submarines, our heavy bombers, and our intercontinental ballistic missiles at a time when there's a big budget crunch. So if you can have another arms agreement that brings the numbers down, that's going to result in some significant cost savings. And that money can go either to reducing the deficit or to military operations that the military is much more likely to conduct than thermonuclear war. And the other reason is it will burnish our credentials in the nonproliferation area. The United States and Russia today control about 95% of the nuclear weapons in the world. If we're not seen as reducing those weapons, it makes it harder for us to argue to other countries, you shouldn't acquire weapons, or for us to mobilize pressure by countries, for example, to apply additional sanctions on Iran or North Korea.
You say burnishing credits. I gather we need some credit burnishing.
We want to have credibility. And what you don't want to have is a situation where a country can say, well, why are you asking us to reduce our weapons or to pressure Iran against getting nuclear weapons when the United States has, you know, half the nuclear weapons in the world virtually? And so if the United States and Russia are seen as actively reducing their stockpiles, we're going to have greater diplomatic credibility. Now, that won't change what goes on in North Korea or Iran in terms of their decision-making. But what it does do is it gives us greater ability to get third countries to go out, apply sanctions and other pressures, and try to keep the pressure on in Iran, or to prevent another country from going down the nuclear weapons route.
Well, 5,000 warheads at this point, what's the optimum number? For defensive purposes, how many would we need?
I'm not sure. I think you could argue. In the book, we argue that the next step ought to be to reduce U.S. and Russian arsenals down to about 2,000 to 2,500 nuclear weapons each. And that we're counting not only what the New START Treaty counts, which is deployed strategic weapons, but we'd also count tactical weapons and non-deployed weapons. So for the first time, you'd bring all nuclear weapons into the mix. That would be about a 50% reduction from where the United States is today, but it would still leave the United States and Russia each with 7 to 8 times as many weapons as the nearest third country nuclear power.
In April 2010, President Obama signed the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with Russia, and that was during a visit to Prague in the Czech Republic. The treaty put a limit on the number of nuclear arms each side is allowed to have. So tell us a little bit about those limits. What are they?
What the treaty, the two principal limits was each side's allowed to have 700 deployed strategic delivery vehicles. And what that counts is it counts bombers, but it also counts an intercontinental ballistic missile in its silo or a submarine-launched ballistic missile in a missile tube on a submarine. Those are the things that are most readily usable. So it doesn't limit, for example, if there's a missile sitting in a storage bunker somewhere. And then the more important limit, I think, is on warheads. Each side's allowed 1,550 deployed strategic warheads. Now, there's a little bit of arms control math here. And that is, it counts the actual number of warheads on a ballistic missile. But since neither the American nor the Russian air forces keep weapons on their bombers, the negotiation said, we're going to count a bomber as one weapon. That's a bit artificial because bombers can carry many more than one weapons. But there's always been sort of this idea in arms control that because bombers It takes them 10 hours to get to their targets, whereas a ballistic missile can arrive in 20, 25 minutes. The idea has already been that bombers maybe get more lenient treatment. So when you say 1,550 warheads under that, each side would probably maintain somewhere between 1,800 and 2,000. And again, our argument in the book is that number, it's good that they're coming down, but we think that the sides could reduce further, and it would result in a greater safety and security for the United States.
Now, you've noted that the U.S.-Russian strategic balance is stable and that the numbers are declining. So I guess, looking from the outside, one of the first questions I'm tempted to ask is, are we safe? Are we safer, or can we do more?
I think the more that we can reduce the stockpiles of the Russians, you know, I don't think the president or people in the Pentagon lay awake late at night worrying about a Russian missile attack. But on the other hand, I would feel better if there were fewer than 2,000 Russian nuclear weapons that could reach the United States. And again, if we can make this reduction, it not only reduces the Russian threat to the United States, there are potential cost savings involved. It makes our non-proliferation position stronger. And then we may then get to a stage where we could begin to say to third countries, you need to get involved in the process. And I think there's room for one more U.S.-Russian negotiation. But after that, it's going to be time to go to the British, French, and Chinese and others and say, you know, nuclear reductions cannot just be a U.S.-Russia process. You have to begin to get involved.
Periodically, we hear from foreign policy experts like Sam Nunn, the former senator and defense secretary, Senator Richard Lugar, that more attention needs to be paid to the Russian nuclear stockpile. Where does that project stand right now?
I actually think, and this is largely due on, and both Senators Nunn and Lugar deserve a huge amount of credit for this. In the early 1990s, they started what became known as the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. And the idea here was that the United States would provide assistance to Russia and also other countries in the post-Soviet space after the Soviet Union collapsed to help them secure nuclear weapons and help them secure nuclear materials. So, for example, we bought railway cars which were armored to give the Russians more secure means in which to move their nuclear weapons around the country. And the idea here was this was an American investment in making sure those nuclear weapons remained under Russian control, did not fall into the hands of, you know, the worst nightmare scenario would be a terrorist group. I served as an ambassador in Ukraine at the end of the 1990s, and we spent probably over the course of the last 15 years about $600 million in Ukraine in the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. That money went to eliminating ballistic missile silos. Ukraine inherited in 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, what would have been the world's third largest nuclear force. That money went to eliminating the missiles. I got to go see with Senator Lugar as they chopped up a bomber one time. We blew up the missile silos. We got rid of systems that could have delivered 2,000 nuclear weapons against the United States. And I think that was a great investment. And as a result of this, the sense is that probably the weapons in Russia are pretty secure. The sorts of concerns people had in the 1990s about what was called loose nukes, there's a sense now that really the Russians, with a good amount of U.S. assistance, have pretty good control over the weapons.
And yet, the efforts seem to have taken a long time from the collapse of the Iron Curtain to the present day to make sure that those nuclear materials don't fall into the wrong hands. Yeah. Why so long?
Well, a lot of it was done. First of all, though, you have to remember this was a fairly delicate process because in some cases you were talking about Americans going to sites that they'd never been to in Russia. One of the things that we had to do was, you know, how do we design our assistance so that it's most effective? But that meant the Russians opening up and talking about, you know, nuclear weapon storage sites in some cases. A lot of the assistance went to help the Russians eliminate ballistic missile submarines. Okay, how do you do that in a way? And where the Russians want the assistance, we want to provide the assistance. But there's also a sense on both sides that this is an area that's a bit sensitive, and the Russians have to structure the process so that they're not revealing all the design secrets that they've spent so much time trying to keep from us. So there was a little bit of sort of feeling out in that new ground on both sides.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Stephen Pfeiffer. He's director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative and author of a new book, The Opportunity, Next Steps in Reducing Nuclear Arms. He speaks this afternoon at 5:30 about the future of arms control. The lecture is in the Greenspun Hall Auditorium at UNLV, and it's free and open to the public. So I guess almost a quarter century now after the fall of the Iron Curtain, is Russia really the biggest nuclear threat to the U.S. anymore, or is there a new number two, if you will?
I think there's the holdover still on both sides. There's still lingering thinking from the Cold War. My guess, though, is that if you look at the world today, the nuclear threat is different. When I was young, and my first real world event was 50 years ago, the Cuban Missile Crisis, where I realized there's an outside world there and it can be a danger. And so for kids, people of my generation, the threat was this nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union that would have been civilization-ending. Today, I think that kind of threat, the risk of that between the United States and Russia is virtually zero. I mean, it's very hard to see circumstances leading to that kind of conflict. But paradoxically, I think the worry is that there's probably a greater likelihood today of a nuclear weapon being used somewhere. And that's because you have more states that have nuclear weapons. Some of these states are fairly fragile. I mean, I'm not sure many people are comfortable about the idea that Pakistan or North Korea have nuclear weapons. Iran may be moving to acquire nuclear weapons. Iran is certainly, at a minimum, moving to acquire the capability where it could put together a nuclear weapon fairly quickly if it wanted to. And I think that as the number of nuclear weapon states grow, the risk that a weapon would be used is growing. And also, we don't have a lot of good sense, for example. I mean, I think the weapons in Pakistan are secure. I think the Pakistani military is professional in how they maintain those weapons. But there are large parts of Pakistan that the government doesn't control. Al-Qaeda operates there. We can't be totally comfortable about that.
So why do you think it is that it's more likely that rogue states may use nuclear weapons? Is it ultimately that they simply don't understand just what happens when something like that is done?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of sense that said people say, look at the United States and the Soviet Union, and they managed the Cold War with nuclear weapons. And we did. Nuclear deterrence worked. And probably kept the United States and the Soviet Union from going to war, which they might have done in a world without nuclear weapons. But having said that, we got really lucky. Go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. President Kennedy made a decision ultimately to impose a naval blockade on the island of Cuba. And in doing so, he overruled the advice of most of his military and civilian advisors who advocated airstrikes against Cuba followed by an invasion. What we learned not in 1962, but in the early 1990s, was the Soviet commander on Cuba. He could not launch missiles against the United States, but he had already been given release authority to use tactical nuclear weapons against invading American forces or against Guantanamo. So these things could have spun out of control very, very quickly, and that's sort of the worrisome thing. And then when you go to a place like India and Pakistan, where I think they're trying to manage the relationship, but those countries have gone to war, three times in the last 45, 50 years? So I think there is grounds here to say that some of these relationships are not so stable. And if we can find a way to reduce the nuclear element, that's going to be to the benefit of everyone's security.
You use the term tactical nuclear weapons. And most of us, and I'm among them, don't necessarily understand the difference between strategic arms and tactical weapons. What are the differences between the two?
It tends to turn less on the weapon itself and more on the range of the delivery system. So what we would traditionally call strategic would be an intercontinental ballistic missile. We have about 450 of those sitting out in Montana and North Dakota and Wyoming, and they can fly 7,000-8,000 miles. Or we would talk about a strategic weapon being on a submarine-launched ballistic missile, which the Trident missile can go perhaps 5,000 to 6,000 miles range. Tactical weapons would be on, say, tactical fighter aircraft, much shorter ranges. Now, at one time, you mentioned when we had 31,000 nuclear weapons back in the 1960s, we had nuclear artillery, artillery shells that could be fired, nuclear torpedoes. Now, happily, a lot of those are now completely out of the inventory. But it really depends on the range of the system.
The treaty between the U.S. and Russia only covers strategic weapons, right. So non-strategic weapons are not constrained by any treaty. Do you see that as a problem?
Well, this is one of the reasons why we'd argue there's an opportunity here to do something more. If you look at the New START treaty, when it comes into full effect, when the limits are fully implemented in 2018, it'll cover about 30% of the weapons in the American stockpile. And so what we'd argue is it's now time to broaden that and capture not only the tactical weapons, but also the U.S. military for reasons both of to hedge against a technological surprise or to hedge against a geopolitical surprise. It's believed that the U.S. military keeps about one reserve warhead for every one deployed strategic warhead. So we think it's now time to bring all of those weapons into the mix, and you could do that in a new arms negotiation with the Russians.
Things have become so much more transparent now, which means the U.S. has a better idea about the stockpile of others, but it also means they know about us as well. Does that level the playing field, or is there some kind of danger in letting other countries know about our supplies?
As a general, I would argue more transparency about these things is good. And in fact, if you go back and look during the ratification debate for the New START Treaty, one of the things that the Joint Chiefs were very, very strong on in terms of their very strong support for the treaty was they said, this treaty gives us verification measures. Data exchanges. Just last month, the United States and Russia conducted another semi-annual data exchange. The sides exchange data. They provide notifications. There have been thousands of notifications exchanged between Washington and Moscow regarding strategic forces over the last 18 months. And it provides each side the opportunity 18 times a year to conduct an on-site inspection. And what the military says is this is going to give us a lot more knowledge about Russian strategic forces. And that's good for the U.S. military because then on our side, they can make smarter decisions about how they equip, operate, and train U.S. forces. So transparency is seen on the American side as largely a plus. Now, sometimes it gets difficult because we have to show the Russians what? And so you get into a little bit new ground, but I think on balance, the U.S. side has found that greater transparency is very, very useful.
Do you ever see a day when the world is rid of nuclear weapons?
I think that that's a goal that we ought to consider. And the reason why I would argue it might be good from the American perspective, and this is looking at this just in U.S. security terms, is we have friendly neighbors in Canada and Mexico. We have the Pacific Ocean. We have the Atlantic Ocean. An adversary who wants to come get us has to come a long way. And in doing so, they're going to have to get past the world's most powerful conventional forces and the world's strongest navy. So I look at that world and say, that's actually may not be a bad world for the United States. Now, there's the question, how do we extend deterrence? How do we help protect our allies? And we certainly want to make the world, we don't want a world safe for conventional war. Mm-hmm. But I think that that is a world that we ought to look seriously at compared with, I think, the growing risks of a nuclear world. Now, certainly, I'm a realist. If you want to get to a non-nuclear world, a nuclear weapons-free world, a lot of things have to happen. First, it can't just be a U.S.-Russian agreement. Every state that has nuclear weapons has to agree to limit them.
And a lot of them have not signed on.
A lot of them, yeah. This is tricky. So no one's talking about the United States going to zero if the others aren't going to zero. But you know, can you somehow persuade these others? That's a hard thing to do. Second, your verification techniques are going to have to improve. You know, right now, under the New START Treaty, if a side hides 100 extra warheads, it doesn't really matter given the large numbers. If you're in a nuclear weapons-free world and somebody hides 100 weapons, it matters a lot. Third, you're going to have an enforcement mechanism because no one's going to want to commit to a nuclear weapons-free world unless they see that there's a mechanism that would punish any country fairly quickly if it was seen to violate that. And then finally, I think you're going to have progress in resolving some of the big conflicts. I mean, countries acquire nuclear weapons for reasons. You know, can you resolve the Kashmir crisis between Pakistan and India? What about Taiwan? How do you improve American-Russian, Russian-Chinese relations so that the sides either say, okay, this dispute is resolved, or we don't feel that nuclear weapons will help resolve those? So those are really tough conditions. And so I think there's the goal is worth looking at and the goal is worth seeking, but I'm not sure we could ever get there. But in the process, you can design sort of a series of steps that move you in that direction that I would argue would make the United States more secure on their own, but also might put you in a place where you could say, can we actually then move further in this? Sam Nunn makes this argument all the time, and he's been a strong advocate along with former Republican Secretary of State George Shultz. And Henry Kissinger, and then Bill Perry from the Clinton administration for a nuclear weapons-free world. And what Senator Nunn says is, you know, the nuclear weapons-free world, it's a mountaintop, and we're at the base of the mountain. And he says, what you do is you've got to climb up, and you establish a base camp, and then you look around, and you say, can you get to the top? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's a good analogy to use, trying to move towards that top of that mountain, and understand that we may not be able to get there.
Stephen Pfeiffer, thanks so much. It's been great having you here.
Thank you.
Stephen Pfeiffer is director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative. His new book is called The Opportunity, Next Steps in Reducing Nuclear Arms. He speaks tonight about the future of arms control. His lecture takes place at 5:30 in the Greenspun Hall Auditorium at UNLV, and it is open to the public. Our producers are Lee Hernandez and Carolyn Kresser. The web editor is Marie Andrusovich. Our technical director is Rich Copeland. Ian Milchrist is senior producer of the program. Our intern is Melanie Arambula, and the news director of Nevada Public Radio is Adam Burke. You can continue the conversations from today's program by going to knprtalk.org. I'm Dave Becker. Thanks for joining us today for KNPR's State of Nevada.